Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of the Proper Class Podcast. I'm Laura Checkley.
And I'm Hannah Chiswick.
And we are of course here to celebrate all things working class, because if we don't, who the bloody hell will?
As always, we sit down with a working class hero to celebrate their life and achievements and discuss just how they got to where they are today. And on that note, who are we celebrating this week, Laura?
Well, this week's guest is actually quite a big deal, so much so that I am concerned that this intro of their achievements might take up the entire episode.
Get on with it then.
All right. Has the heat got to someone there, Hannah?
Actually, the heat has actually got to me. That's the truth. Do you remember that episode of Friends? Do you remember when Monica went, I don't know where she'd gone, but basically she had some sort of like humidity issue and her hair got bigger and bigger. Well, basically that's me, except I'm more southeast London than south LA, but nevertheless, anyway, get on with it.
It's that humidity. They went on holiday, didn't they?
That's literally my hair. And for those of us who actually can see each other right now, you'd all agree that
it
is
actually doesn't look that bad. This week's guest hails from County Dublin, Ireland. Whilst at uni studying horticulture, he started up his own comedy night, which was such a success that he jacked in his studies and headed to the bright lights of London to seek out his fortune.
Made him sound like Dick Whittington there.
I've been walking for miles and there's still no sign of Dick. It's something like that.
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, it turned out to be a wise choice because he went from strength to strength. And at the 1998 Edinburgh Festival, he was nominated for the prestigious Comedy Award. Since then, he has continued to take the festival by storm with 8 sellout shows and no doubt another one this year. In 2006, his show Standing Up and Falling Down was the best-selling comedy show at the festival. Wow. He has toured the UK and Ireland extensively, again packing out venue after venue. Not content with that, he hit the international circuit playing top comedy clubs around the globe and repeating his sellout successes in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and even smashing it in the US of A. He recorded 3 DVDs of his hit stand-up tours, Pedantic and Whimsical, Crowd Pleaser, and the appropriately titled for our podcast anyway, Different Class, in which he talks about his upbringing, his parents, and the class divide. His new tour, Tragedy Plus Time, is now on sale, so get buying, folks. The show is inspired by the quote attributed to Mark Twain, humour is defined as tragedy plus time, and uses the most tragic event in our guest's life as its starting point. The show will open this August at the Edinburgh Festival before touring the UK until the end of the year.
Told you there was loads to say. Unless you've been living under a rock the past couple of decades, you will have seen this man on your TV screens and heard him on your radio many, many times as both presenter and panellist on shows such as Mock the Week, Have I Got News for You, The Unbelievable Truth, What's So Funny, and The Graham Norton Show. He is even a regular face on US TV, making 5 appearances on NBC's Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He also hosted 4 series of Ed Burns' Just for Laughs, no more secrets who our guest is now, on RTE. And if Wikipedia is to be believed, he was even on Blind Date.
No.
Let's find out if that's true in a moment.
Oh, my God.
He has also presented factual pieces for Countryfile, The One Show and Science Club. But the thing I am most jealous of, though, is that he drove across Siberia for the world's most dangerous roads. I want to do that so badly. I'm literally obsessed with that programme. If you ever get asked to go on it, Laura, you have to take me with you.
Well, I'll have to because I don't drive, do I?
Oh, yeah, there is that. Well, I don't care how I get to go on it. I'm happy to drive.
You would be hard-pushed to find a comedian with better reviews than our guest. Repeatedly praised as one of our greatest comedians, a master of observational comedy, combining a self-deprecating humour with an effortless stage presence that fills every room he performs in. Recently, he returned to his roots as the face of Tourism Ireland. But surely, surely his biggest achievement to date must be, well, some might say, becoming a dad, but I'm going to say winning All-Star Family Fortunes. Listeners, yes, give a huge Proper Class podcast welcome to the hilarious and utterly brilliant Ed Byrne. Hey. And breathe.
Well, there is a lot there, isn't there? There's a lot there.
You've been busy.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. You had to leave out quite a bit, though, didn't you, Han, as well?
I was like, literally it's going to be the whole 45 minutes if I carry on, so...
I mean, with such a long list, I'm almost disappointed it's me.
Oh. And were you really on Blind Date?
Yeah, that happened. That absolutely happened, yeah. Back when I was in... It was before I became a stand-up, and I had just... I think at the time I was still working in the student union at Strathclyde Uni. It was mad. I've done a lot of stuff over the years, but I've never been as famous as I was when I was on Blind Date.
Isn't that fucking infuriating?
And were you the contestant or were you looking for a date, Ed?
No, I was one of the people giving answers. I was one of the two people not to get picked. That's who I was. She ended up picking Gavin, the strippogram from King's Lynn. He was the one that she went off with.
Oh, well, yeah, sure.
And they went on a day trip to Cambridge. He's from King's Lynn.
Cambridge?
He would do his...
It's up the road,
as he said himself,
it?
His mum goes shopping in Cambridge. That is a piss poor date. Yeah.
Oh, what a shame.
I think
shame.
The previous couple had just come back from Tenerife or something like that for a week.
Oh, you'd be gutted, wouldn't you?
So listen, Ed, we start each week asking our guests to take us back to a place and time that has some meaning to them, somewhere that has a connection to their working class roots. So if you were able to take us back anywhere today, where would that be?
I mean, I don't know. It would probably be, I don't know, the school I went to, which was called St. Cronin's. Oh, going to have to change that security answer now on me banking. or just the house I grew up in that my parents still live in, you know, which was a semi-detached in Swords. And I guess that would be a place that defined me, a place that I grew out of, yeah.
And what's, I mean, obviously, we'll talk about your school in a minute, but with your house, what was the setup? Did you have siblings?
Yes.
Was it, you were, you know, like what you said was a terrace house, was it?
No, it was a semi-detached. Small garden. That show, Different Class, that I did was all about the fact that when my upbringing was a weird, I was never particularly avowedly, I was either working class or middle class. I had this weird in-between thing.
Yeah.
That I was, you know, middle class people would have said that I was working class. But we didn't live in like a council house. We didn't, you know, we lived in a, you know, we had our own house. There were certain aspects of our upbringing that were middle class. And then other aspects that were avowedly working class, you know, like my parents didn't go to university, but over the years, they kind of had a sort of aspirational thing where they sort of moved up through the classes pretty much after I left home. So my dad was an aircraft mechanic. He was a sheet metal worker.
Oh, wow.
You know, but by the time he retired, he had sort of moved off the shop floor and went from fixing airplanes to pointing at people and telling them to fix airplanes, you know.
It's an interesting conversation, one that we always have on here often about moving through the classes, you know, like, you know, I'd look at my life now and say it's obviously very middle class or what people would consider middle class. But I still feel very, very working class at my roots. I think there's something about like what makes one working class. Is it?
Yeah.
What you've got in front of you, how you grew up, your ethic. And I think like there's this thing about being working class that we're not allowed to work up through the ranks and do better. Suddenly we then become something else.
Yes. The concept of aspiration sometimes can be very frowned upon.
Right.
Yeah. And how was that in your house? Were your parents very aspirational for you?
Well, yeah. Three of the four of us ended up going to, you know, university. But we were the first of our generation was the first in our family to do that.
Yeah.
And my sister was the only one who actually finished it. And I remember, because my sister went to Trinity College, and I remember within a week she came home speaking in a different accent. and we absolutely hammered her for it, you know.
Of course.
And suddenly, like, she would bring mates home that were, they seemed like they were from another planet, when actually they were just from the south side of the city we grew up in.
Yeah.
Would you say that sort of everyone living around you was in a pretty similar, this the way you just described it, sort of halfway between working class and middle class? Like, were you aware of class as a child, or was everyone just sort of on a similar level?
No, it was very, very mixed. And that was the curious thing. Because a lot of places I've lived since have been avowedly one thing or another.
Sure.
Whereas the town I grew up in, Swords, was always very mixed. And the school I went to was very mixed. So, like, I went to a Christian Brothers school for 4 years, and literally there were people in that school. There was a guy in that school who won the Young Scientist of the Year competition. But there was also people in my class who went to jail for armed robbery, you know. So it was right across the board. And the town itself, you know, you had really, really posh bits. Like, Ronan Keating grew up in one of the estates not far from where I lived. But then you also had, you know, really rough council estates, like, right next door. So it was all very, and all cheek by jowl, you know. So, mm-hmm. And it actually made for a lot more trouble than you would get in somewhere that was maybe just a bit more uniform, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, for sure.
And how did that, because I grew up in an area that was quite like that, actually, because I went to a big comp on a housing estate in South London, and one side of it was like this massive estate that was, well, all you need to know about it is they knocked it down, and it was long overdue that they knocked it down. And then the other side, I mean, I think that people would have knocked it down themselves. And at the same time, we had sort of Blackheath multi-million pound houses at the other end of the long road. And it was a really, like, a strange kind of vibe for that reason. And when you say it sort of caused trouble, how did that sort of play out?
Well, just at the weekend in the town centre, you know,
Yeah.
It was that a kicking out time. There was generally, you know, somebody getting their head kicked in. about the size of it. And strongest memories about with the whole class thing is that it seemed like the lower a person's class, the more money they had. That was the really weird thing, because, and maybe that's more of an Irish thing, but you had, like, for instance, a communion or confirmation. The people who you knew to be, you know, sort of, you know, it was council estate kids who were coming in with scads. We were talking about how much money did you get for your confirmation. It's like, I got, like, totaled up to about £37. Oh, really? I got 180. And it's like, this was in the early 80s. Yeah, I'm talking, you know, these were kids who you knew were, like, were really, really working class kids, because you had that kind of cash is king.
Yeah,
sort of,
yeah, right.
And you could also get people who are apparently sort of landed gentry and have no money. You know, they're living in houses that are falling
down. Yeah,
cash
poor. Yeah,
that weird thing.
It's that thing. I mean, I just on a different, slightly different level, but, like, I would absolutely spend, I would have spent my last tenner putting it in someone's birthday card and showing up in all the gear. You know, you'd never know I didn't have any money. And it was the same with my family. We would probably give more than we had, just because it's about showing and look. It's about looking like we're all right. We're doing all right. You don't have to worry about us over here. I know me and Hannah have often gone down to the down to the pub with our last tenner and gone, oh, you know, fuck it. You know, like, life's too short.
Yeah.
Let me just take you back to school, Ed. How was it? Were you academic? Did you get on all right?
I was all right. But then again, it was, you know, you weren't supposed to be smart at school. I did not go to a school where being clever was considered something that you would aim for. And now, here's the weird thing. That wouldn't just be with the kids. That'd be with the teachers as well.
Really?
Like, you could sense when you answered a question correctly, a teacher would go, this fucking smart arse. Yeah, I'm not making that up. I am not kidding. Yeah.
That's not the school I signed up for. Yeah.
Yeah. And you had teachers that only cared about whether or not you were good at football. And by football as well, not soccer, Gaelic football. That was all they cared about. You were either good at hurling or you were good at Gaelic football. And if you weren't good at either of them, they didn't give a shit whether you did your fucking commerce homework, you know.
Oh, that's, I love the idea of teachers actually being pissed off that you gave a shit about their subjects.
Yeah.
So when you're at school and obviously you're not wanting to be too clever, is that where the being funny started? Was that what did that often that, you know, you talk to comedians and funny people and they go, I did that to survive, you know, or there was a reason why someone was often trying to be funny at school.
I think so a bit. But it's funny, I can even remember, I don't know why I just think you remember this particular answer. I remember knowing the answer to a question. It was in history and it was what did the Treaty of Versailles basically say? And I remember trying to give the answer in the most casual way of trying not to sound academic, but still get the answer right. That was a sort of, that was the way I was always couching the way, they basically said the war was all Germany's fault and they had to, you know, pay for it. You know, just trying to put it in as much of a layman's terms as I possibly could so no one hit me for knowing the answer.
That is so brilliant.
But I also remember not so much telling jokes to avoid bullying as perhaps attracting bullying by trying to be funny all the time. I was probably a fool to myself. And now I was being a bit daft. If you were unruly in class and funny in that way, that got you respect. But when we were outside of the classroom and I was just trying to be funny, that got me a smack because that was like, shut up!
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because then you were just trying to draw attention to yourself and that's no good.
And so when you sort of managed to get through school, and then how was secondary school? A similar sort of story?
Well, that was secondary school as well. I mean, junior school was okay. Junior school was all right because nobody had really formed opinions or minds then. I think everybody
about
just kind of
everybody
just kind of rubbed along.
Isn't it?
Really.
Junior school, it's always so much nicer.
Yeah, it was then when we went on, and that was the weirdest thing I think. But I remember when I moved on to secondary school, people that I knew from junior school, then suddenly when they became teenagers, suddenly are giving you the stink eye because suddenly they realise we're not supposed to be friends. They suddenly go, oh no, you grew up on that estate, and I grew up on this estate. So now, and that was I remember just like walking past people who were suddenly giving me evils. I distinctly remember a guy called Jimmy Curtis, who was at my fifth birthday party. And then at the age of 13, 14, walking past him and him giving me the fucking stink eye. And not a word has been exchanged between us, you know, in 5, 10 years. And then there he's just giving me that. And it's like,
wow, what do you think it was?
He was from Glassmore and I was from Broadmeadow. Like that was about the size of it. Or he'd suddenly joined a boxing club and fancied himself a bit handy.
Yeah, classic.
And I was in a karate club and I, you know, who knows how it would have ended up. So he has to give me an intimidating look. I don't really know. But it was like, I felt like going, we literally haven't spoken since probably we were 8. And we were definitely friends then. So what the fucking deal here? But, you know, well, 14, 15, so it didn't occur to me to say that, you know.
Yeah.
But school, so I was in a Christian Brothers school for 4 years and it was shit. It was actually so bad. It became the first Christian Brothers school to have a lay person as a head teacher. They had to bring in a civilian to be a head teacher and pull it into shape because it had gone down so badly. But the year they did that was the year I left. And I went to the comprehensive on the corner that was right there. It was actually 5 minutes from my house that was considered not as good a school, but actually turned out to be better. So I went there for 2 years. And that was, you know, what got me sort of enough of a result to go to college.
And is that right that you went to uni to study horticulture? Was that something you were really interested in? Or were you just up for going to uni? Or what was that kind of journey to that?
I did just want to go to uni. Again, and this is, I suppose, where I'd be very much more, my working class roots would be at play. I wanted to be an actor, but the idea of going to university to study drama was just not on the cards.
Right.
And it wasn't just that thing of you have to have a trade to fall back on. So you need, it was also just the idea, I couldn't stand the idea of being a drama student. Drama students were wankers as far as I was concerned, as far as anybody I knew was concerned. And so there was that was the double whammy of, I didn't want to be one, but I also needed to get a proper degree. So one of my greatest regrets is that I didn't go to uni and study something related to what it is I wanted to do and wanted to be. Like, I didn't go and do either drama or some sort of theatre or directing or even like TV production or anything like that. Instead, I used to work with my uncle as a gardener, and I thought I could do this, and that way I could be self-employed, and then that way I'd be free to do auditions or whatever it is I wanted to do. I could pursue acting or whatever at a later date, having gotten myself a proper, you know, qualification. Because that was very much a thing that was kind of beaten into you from an early age, that you have to do something proper. Mm. You can't just go off and do something airy-fairy like acting.
And so how did you get into acting then? Was that at school people started telling you it was good, or did you have anyone that you knew that was sort of in the industry? Like, because, I mean, when I grew up, I just didn't know what acting was. No. I obviously had a telly, so I could go, oh, I want to sort of do what she's doing.
No, I mean, literally beyond, you know, there was a school play, you know, but that was about it. But that wasn't even... Every year there was a school play, I think twice in the time I was at junior school, at national school. There was nothing in secondary school. No, there was nothing. I just fancied it. You know, I'd see people doing it. And I was quite funny.
Yeah.
But I didn't think I was funny enough to be a stand-up comedian. But I thought, you know, I could kind of do accents a bit and that sort of thing. So I just thought I'd quite fancied doing acting. I remember doing things like... When we were talking about TV from the night before, and I'd recite a funny thing that happened, and people would laugh. And a couple of them, like, I had one friend called Derek Bishop who, remember, I had said to me, "You should be an actor. You'd be a good actor." I think he was the only guy who ever actually said it to me. But that was
it. Was enough.
Again, it was not something it was an aspiration. But it wasn't something I took seriously.
Yeah, what brought you to acting? Well, it was my mate Derek.
I wonder how that would have gone down.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So when did you actually stand up and do some, like, when did you do your first stand-up? When did you...
My first actual stand-up gig was in a club that I started in Glasgow. So by that point, I had dropped out of university for various reasons. I hated being poor.
Mm.
I hated the course I was doing was 2 years at Strathclyde Uni in Glasgow, and then it was going to be 2 years at the West of Scotland Agricultural College in Auchencruve in Ayr, mm-hmm. which is somewhere I'd love to go and live now. But at the age of 20, I didn't really fancy yeah, sure. it, you know. And then also just finding that, you know, gardening wasn't for me.
And it's quite a lot of commitment for something you're not sure you want to do, isn't it, as well?
Exactly. Just as a fallback position to spend 4 years on it. So I just thought, no, I'm going to give this a whirl. I'm going to actually try and break into it myself. So, you know, by then I decided on stand-up comedy. And yeah, so there wasn't anywhere to play at the time in Glasgow. So I just started up my own club and did it that way. And did it for about, I think, 2 months. I did it every week, emceeing this club. I made no money out of it. All the bar gave me enough money to pay the comedians, and then they took all the money on the bar, and there was a small charge to get in. They took that as well. So I was doing it for nothing, just the experience. And then did that for a couple of months, and then moved to London and just started doing, open mic in London.
I mean, that's such an, I mean, you're saying that like, oh, I just moved to London, but that's such a difficult thing to do, like financially. And were you just sort of like, right, I'm just going to go for it? What did you do? Did you know anyone in London? Did you have anywhere to live? How did you support yourself in those early days?
I was on the dole.
That's
quite simply.
Yeah.
I was on the dole and housing benefit. And I did manage to sign off the dole fairly rapidly, in that it was after about 8-9 months I came off the, well, maybe a year I came off the dole, and then it came off the housing benefit shortly after that. So certainly it was within 2 years I was making enough money to live. But I remember those early days, that was really just things like, if your check came, like you'd be counting on that check plopping through your door in the morning and going and cashing it. And if you didn't have it, then you just, like, I remember having to cancel an open spot because I literally didn't have the money to go to the other side of London because the dole check that was supposed to have come that morning hadn't come. And then the guy not believing me when I phoned him to cancel, because Ireland was playing in the World Cup that night, and he didn't believe that that's the reason I had cancelled. And that's genuinely the reason I had cancelled, because I couldn't give a shit about football. But I literally did sit at home and watch that match.
Sure, sure.
Drinking a pint of water because I didn't have any fucking money at all.
It is something that we talk about, because we always say that, like, there's a level of skint that sometimes people who do have money think they are. So we always laugh about it. People going like, oh, you know, I'm really skint. I've had to dip into my savings. And we're like, no, friend, no, no, no. You know, like you're saying, having to cancel actually getting some work that would give you the money because you haven't got the money to get to the work. Like, you know, that is skint.
Yeah. How do you feel like that? Do you feel like that may have, like, halted you in the early days? Because I know I felt like that as a creative and a writer and stuff. I didn't have the space or time. I was having to take jobs, you know, waitressing or whatever, because I just had to pay my rent. And really what I needed to be doing was getting out there and, you know, doing it. But so did you find like it delayed it somewhat in those early days?
To be honest, it kind of lit a fire under my arse, because I've known a lot of people who had day jobs. Who then were a bit more casual and a bit more lackadaisical about chasing the work. Whereas I would go and do a gig that other people wouldn't want to do for the 15 quid it was offering, because I needed that money. I wanted that money. But how just a tiny thing when you literally have no money, how a little bump in the road will. I remember buying Time Out. The magazine Time Out was an indispensable guide. That was how you found the phone numbers and the addresses of the comedy clubs that you would phone up to work in. Mm-hmm. And so that was an important expense. Every week you buy Time Out. And I remember getting me check, having, I think it was 35 quid. For some reason, I gave the guy the £20 note to buy the Time Out. This was in Camberwell, next door to the Dole office. And him thinking I'd only given him a fiver and given me only change for a fiver, and me going, no, mate, I gave you a 20. And him going, well, we're going to have to check the till, but we don't check that until the end of the day. So I can't, I go, dude, I need this money now. I've got to, and then having my day ruined because I literally, and then going back at the end of the day, and I'm going, oh yeah, you're right, sorry, I was £15 over, here's your 15 quid. But I had to wait all day to get that. And, you know, the day being fucked because, again, that money that I needed to do the things I had to do, I didn't have in my hand.
Like you said, those things do light a fire under your arse, don't they? And we talk about it. We spoke about it with a previous guest about it making you chippy. And do you think like that kind of struggle and having to really kind of scrap your way to where you are, do you think that has come from your working class roots?
Yeah. And I think people who talk about selling out and stuff like that have a tendency to come from a position of comfort.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And if I'm offered a certain amount of money to do something, I look at it as, could I tell my dad I turned that down? And if I couldn't turn around, yeah, well, they offered me this much to do that. And if he was to go, then I go, no, that's too much money to turn down for that.
Yeah, totally.
So, yes, I was the voice of the Carrefour warehouse. And I also shield for Tesco Mobile, and I don't care.
Oh, yes, that is you. Yes, I totally know. Yes, it's you. You know, when you hear those voices, you're like, who is that? I know that voice. Don't worry, I did, I did a Sun Bingo ad in my time, didn't I, Han?
We make us up what you will.
Oh, I really? Which ones?
I did the Sun Bingo. Mm-hmm. And then I did Paddy Power as well. Yeah, all the greats.
Quite right. When students say that, when they're like, oh, I would never do an advert, I'm like, we'll see.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Let's wait and see in a few years' time how you actually feel about that. So, obviously, you're in London, you're like doing the circuit when you've got enough money to get to the gigs. What would you consider was your sort of big break, if there was one?
There wasn't really a single big break. It was, so I was doing the circuit and had a fairly steady and fairly swift, you know, getting established on the circuit. I was fairly quickly doing all the clubs. And then I did the Edinburgh Fringe in 95, me and two other Irish guys did a show together. And then from that, we got to go to Australia the following year.
Wow.
And do the Melbourne Festival. And I think I did my first TV slot was over there, was in Australia. Because that was back in the day where you could pretend you were famous back home and the internet wasn't strong enough that people could look that up to verify. So you can go, oh, yeah, no, he's a big star in Ireland and England. and then I was Jonathan Ross's big, big talent show in 1996. It was just before going to the Edinburgh Fringe in 96. Jonathan Ross did a kind of opportunity knock style talent show. So I did 5 minutes on that. And that sold out my Edinburgh run, which then gave me a momentum in Edinburgh that carried through year on year after that, pretty much. And then in 98, as you mentioned, got nominated for the Perrier Award. So
yeah, you once upon a time did those sort of shows, didn't you? And there were hardly any channels, you know. It's kind of taken on a different way now, isn't it? Stand-up comedy. You can get on TikTok, can't you? And just sort of put a few funny things out there. And it just works so differently now, doesn't it? Trying to start a stand-up career, it seems, from the outside anyway.
Well, there's a lot more channels now that you can do it through. But it's interesting, even though we've got more channels now, there was bigger comedy shows later on. So when I was starting out, there was the stand-up show and things like that. And they weren't really very big. They were maybe watched by a million people, which I guess would be big now, but then wasn't that big. Mm. But then the sort of Live at the Apollo came along. Like, that was this midway through my career. But you had things like Live at the Apollo and Michael McIntyre's Roadshow. And you could have a couple of people like, what's his name? Kevin Bridges. Like, Kevin Bridges did one slot.
Wow.
One really, really good slot on McIntyre's Roadshow. And bosh, he was selling out the Hydro in Glasgow.
Wow.
I mean, he had the material to back it up,
yeah.
You know, but you do occasionally get a case of a TV slot just absolutely catapulting you and just skyrocketing you. But now there's just so many different ways to get your face out there. You can just keep churning out videos on Instagram and build your and TikTok and build your following that way. It's not limited to just doing the clubs anymore.
And so Did your what was your parents' thoughts about all this when you decided to drop out of uni and head to London and pursue comedy? Were they supportive? Were they concerned? What did they think about it?
Their take on it was they were happy to support me while I was at university, but they were not going to support me moving to London.
Right.
You know, sort of on spec to just, you know, if I wanted to move home, I could move in with them while I was trying to get going, but they weren't going to just send money to London to support what sounded like a very odd proposal. That was pretty much.
And as time went on.
Well, as time went on, they're my biggest fans, you know, without a doubt. But and now they don't need to send me any money to support me anymore.
Well, sure.
But, you know, I'm not sending them any.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm always really fascinated about this. Like, but do you feel like, obviously, you've had like a great level of success, and I'm sure your life or lifestyle potentially is different to how you grew up. But is your children's life very different to your life as a child?
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. And I've talked about this on stage. I think, and this will partly be just a generational thing. It'll just be because, you know, we're older. And times change. But I think also there will be a class aspect to this. But I think the main thing that gets me is when I look at the amount of parenting I'm expected to do versus the amount of parenting I myself received, I don't think that tallies up. You know, I feel like I could have left my children in a field at the age of six. And never seen them again, and I'd still have done more parenting than my dad did his entire life.
That is so true, isn't it? The amount of energy you're meant to put in, the amount of kind of clubs and how much you're supposed to nurture your children's very not possible talents, who knows?
Yeah, it's that thing of like, oh, he's humming a tune. Let's get him singing lessons. Oh, look, he seems to be just tapping away on the table. Buy him a drum kit. Look, he's skipping around the garden. Ballet lessons now.
Where does that start? Is it because we had so little or less growing up that you kind of just want to give them everything? Or is it just because there's just such a pressure these days to go, kids have to be into everything, put them in this club, do it? Was it a combination of both? I mean, I'm not a parent, so.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think it's just the fact that there is so much choice. But I think you also have to be so much more involved in it as well. In that, and partly maybe it's just because of where I live. You can't get anywhere. You've got to get in the car. So I can't just send the kids off. Mm. Like when I was a kid, if you wanted to go to something, you could get the bus or you could walk to it. So I, you know, I did karate in the school I used to go to. You know, the junior school I went to was also where the karate class was that I went. So I would just walk to it.
Yeah, right.
And I walked to school from a fairly early age. But we have to take our kids in the car to school every morning. So I guess they don't even get that social aspect or even the sort of rough and tumble school of hard knocks aspect of they don't have to walk through a scary council estate to get home.
So obviously, like, your life's very different now, and we're all coming at this from a place of privilege, really. But do you think, have you ever experienced, I know a lot of people do, so particularly if you are working class, you found yourself in environments that are less working class. Do you ever get imposter syndrome? Do you feel a level of that at all when you're at, you know, swanky awards ceremonies or?
Well, I'm quite aware of the fact that a lot of our social circle now, not in my friends in comedy, but now, like, where we live near Saffron Walden, a lot of the people that we might go to their houses for dinner, I am aware that I am not the same. And, you know, they'll make fun of me because I referred to me dinner as me tea or whichever one I've gotten wrong. I went to somebody's house once and they had a conniption because I fucking sat down at the table before the women had fucking sat down.
Get out.
Hang on.
Had you time
I am not
traveled?
Kidding you. What? I am not fucking making this up. Oh, I mean, two of them had gone to Eton. I mean, it was just...
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go.
So I'm aware of that. Yeah.
Oh, Lord, yeah. Does that make you chippier, or does it make you sort of feel like, oh, right, I'll try and do the right thing to make everyone else feel comfortable? Or you just think, oh, fuck them. I'm sat, there's a chair I'm sitting.
I do feel like, I mean, I did get up, but I also thought, we are not coming to this house again for dinner.
Yeah, that's what I'd have done.
I'll get through this, but then that's it. And there's class and there's xenophobia, all kind of seem wrapped up in one. There's being Irish and people using terms like, oh, that's a bit Irish for when talking about something that's a bit backward or a bit wrong.
Yes, people will still
do that. So I'm kind of aware of all of that. With the kids, I'm very aware that the kids are posher than me. But I mean, aside from that, just the fact they have English accents is enough to set me on edge.
Oh no!
I find it a lot easier when we go and spend time with my wife's family in Derbyshire because they're farmers, and then my kids will kind of top up their Derbyshire accents while we're there, and then I find it much easier to take them talking about the difference between something that's jiggered and something that's buggered, and I find that a lot easier to listen to.
Yeah.
Then, Daddy, is there any more elderflower cordial?
Yeah.
I often think about that with my son. I just think, like, the things that I know, it's so specific, but the things that he has eaten and drunk, and he is 7 years old.
He likes olives and hummus and all that, doesn't he?
Yeah. What a dickhead. I mean, honestly.
I think I discovered hummus in my 30s.
I'm 51 and I still don't like olives.
Well, they're awful.
They do say that if you eat 14 olives in a row, you acquire the taste, apparently.
Right, why bother?
I don't know.
Mm. Why would you bother with that?
Keep up with the Joneses, keep up with my posh mates.
No.
All right, fine. No.
No, I think it was Jackie Mason. Jackie Mason always used to say, yeah, you ever have to cultivate a taste for potato chips? No, because they taste good.
I was going to ask you a question, Ed, actually, about comedy and stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
It always feels like quite an inherently working class, or it did. There's nothing to stop you there getting up on stage with a microphone, going to starting in all the working men's clubs and stuff. Do you find that a lot of stand-up comedians are working class?
I think there's probably, if you go on the circuit, I think generally there's probably slightly more middle class ones, but I think when the working class ones come along, they tend to cut through and sound different, and I don't know, they tend to end up doing better. So I think of Rob Beckett and Kevin Bridges being two recent ones. But I also think of, I mean, Peter Kay sounds quite working class. I don't know that he is, you know, that working class.
Yeah.
But certainly Michael McIntyre isn't.
No, he's middle class, isn't he?
What?
So I think there's a mix, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I think maybe I was thinking more about, like, in the 80s, you think back to all those stand-up comedians that started in the working men's club. It felt like a real working class kind of, I think it's definitely changed over the years.
I think it's slightly more middle class nowadays because, like, a lot of things, it's that thing of you've got to do it for free for ages and you've got to be able to afford.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, right.
And that's
you,
it, right.
And to get on, you know, you might have to have the money to put on a show at the Edinburgh Fringe or to live or at least commute in and out of London on the reg in order to get going on the circuit there. And I think things like that where you're not being paid straight away, where there's certainly no apprenticeship route in, you end up with more middle class people doing it. So I think it's kind of swung the other way since the working men's club days.
Yeah. And are you seeing that? Are you seeing that on the circuit now? Like, just sort of less working class people coming up?
Yeah, I would say there. I'd say there's not as many.
Yeah.
But as I say, then the ones that come along have a tendency to cut through.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think there's also a hunger on the part of the media to have more working class voices on screen and on stage. I think there's definitely a desire for that.
We're going to wrap up soon, Ed, because we can't keep your dad. I'd love to keep talking about this. We always finish the show asking our guest if there's any, obviously we've celebrated you today, is there a working class hero that you can think of that springs to mind that you'd like to celebrate today?
Well, I think Billy Connolly was probably the best one,
best example
in that he would talk about stuff that wasn't really talked about on TV that much and that you could relate to. particularly the idea gathering the nicest pieces of furniture from the house to put them in one room for when somebody's coming over and that being the room that they would then guide them into, you know,
I love stuff that, like that. Yeah.
And his memory of people going, oh, the deprivation. I didn't really think of it as deprivation at the time, you know. What was great about him is seeing him on something like Parkinson and stuff like that, surrounded by a lot of the time these, you know, intellectuals or, you know, the great and the good, and having them all pissing themselves laughing with his patter and just sort of owning the space while being, you know, a working class man. I think that was something that was quite, it sticks in your mind growing up.
An incredibly like bright and erudite one too, right? Like just because he had that thick Scottish accent. It's, people are so judgmental about accents and being working class and that we're without academia or we're not academic. And surely one of the greatest of all time, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. I'm sorry, I never got to meet him. I don't mean to talk about it he's retired now.
My chances of meeting him have
gone down considerably.
Yeah, of course.
I never got to come across him.
What a shame. And is there anyone else you would celebrate in terms of like one that isn't a celebrity? Is there anyone you can think of like mums, dads, nans or?
Yeah, well, my granny, I think, was pretty awesome. My mother's mother, because I didn't know this. But my mother, I mean, I knew this bit. My mother grew up in a really quite nice house on the south side of Dublin in a place called Rendla. And her dad was a postman. He was a post rider in that he rode a motorbike delivering the post. And I remember quite late on in life just sort of putting everything together and going, how did you guys grow up in that house in Rendla? When Bump, as we knew him, was a postman. And she said, we squatted it.
No way, that's brilliant. Oh, I love that.
She says that she remembers as a kid doing colouring books by candlelight in this house that had only just been built and the electricity hadn't even been turned on yet. And they just kind of went, it was like, we're having this. I mean, I think they paid a price. They didn't just steal it, but they got it for a knockdown price because it had squatters in it.
That is so brilliant. What was your nan's name?
Well, as kids, we called her Gaggy, but she was known as Di, even though her real name was Bessie.
I love that.
That was another thing growing up. Nobody's name was really their name.
That to me is like just 100% standard working class stuff, isn't it? Well, Ed, we're celebrating her, Billy Connolly, and you today. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
No, thanks very much. It was lovely talking to you.
Oh, I love that chat.
What a great guy. So interesting. And I really love his sort of like going, you know what, this is not for me, and giving up on a university course that wasn't working for him and making his way to London and just doing what he knew in his heart he was meant to be doing. I find that sort of courage of youth really admirable.
Yeah. And it's a difficult world, the comedy world. It's really harsh and like we've talked about it and you've heard me harp on about it, how difficult it is to sustain, like Ed said, about paying for your own Edinburghs and that. It really clears you out. I mean, I managed to do 3 Edinburghs and that was me done. Have no money left and, well, didn't have any money at the time, but borrowed money. And, I just really admire the character of a stand-up comedian. I think they have to really, really graft. Particularly when you're not from a privileged background as well. You have to really scrap and stuff. And yeah, he's been going for so long, like, and sustained such a level of a brilliant career for so long. I've got loads of admiration for him.
There's such a pressure in stand-up comedy, isn't there, to stay relevant?
And yeah, it's exhausting,
like,
isn't it?
Really, like, effortlessly.
Yeah,
while still staying true to himself. Do you know what I mean? He's stayed absolutely relevant and contemporary, but in a way that doesn't feel forced. And I think that's really admirable as well. In any industry, in any artistic industry, anyone who sticks it out in over the long haul is just a hero of mine, and he's a particularly hilarious one. So
does that mean I'm a hero of yours then also? Because I've stuck it out.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Oh, how dare you. Oh.
You know you're a hero of mine.
As you are of mine too. I thought it sounded really insincere when I said that.
Don't know.
I actually meant
you'd
it.
Be forced.
And you can catch Ed's show. He's going to be in Edinburgh this year. Honestly, please go. He's amazing. I saw him, years ago now. He feels like he's never aged as well. He just like looks exactly the same.
Like the show's going to be a really personal one as well. No doubt, of course, it's going to be absolutely hilarious, but I think it's going to be just a really special one as well.
Yeah, so if you're up at the Fringe, go and check him out or get a ticket as soon as you can, because I bet it will sell out immediately.
Well, that's that for this series. And what a series it's been.
Yeah, it's been all right. It's been all right.
We've had some insane guests, and also you got married during this season. So, this will always be the season in which you got married.
Did we even ever mention that?
I think we did mention that we're off on your hen do, but probably we didn't mention after the hen do what happened on the hen do, which is probably just as well. So, but yeah, you got married. Woohoo!
I did get married, yeah.
And what a day it was.
Yeah, I wanted to say to Ed, to fellow Dubliner, So I'm going to get me an Irish passport and I'm getting out of here.
I'm so glad you didn't do your Irish accent then, because you would never have got an Irish passport had you done that. What an amazing series. So lucky to have that. Again, I'm just blown away by the people who come on and are so generous talking about their journeys and so inspiring. I sort of wish, this is the podcast I would have liked to listen to as a kid, but there wasn't even podcasts when I was a kid, so...
I know. Now, I want to thank all our guests for this series. It's been brilliant. They give up their time to come and talk to us, and, it's been brilliant, and we'll see you again soon for another one. But until then, stay safe, get the fan out, it's still hot, and keep it classy. Bye!
The Proper Class podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangabee Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music.
Please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at The Proper Class Podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.